Conversation with David Goodman is brought to you by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and by Stowe Cider, Green Mountain Power, Concept 2, Let's Grow Kids, The Alchemist Brewery, and by UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, as well as nearly 700 business members of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Did just want to remind listeners that next week you can hear Vermont Conversation and see it live on Monday night. I'll be with Bill McKibben. We'll be doing a public conversation at Bridgeside Books in Waterbury. That's at 6 p.m., and that show will air next Wednesday as the Vermont Conversation. So come on by to Bridgeside Books, hear Bill McKibben, and get him to sign his new book, Falter, that he'll be talking about at that time. We're going to continue our conversation now, looking at who won, who lost, what's still in play in the Vermont legislature now that the session is recently adjourned. And we've brought back with us for this half hour some of the advocates who have been fixtures around the Vermont State House. They also appeared with us in January as the session began to talk about their priorities, and now we'll hear about how things went for them. We're joined now by Paul Burns, the Executive Director of the Vermont Public Interest Research Group, Lauren Hurl, the Executive Director of Vermont Conservation Voters, and Dan Barlow, the Public Policy Manager of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Welcome back to all of you.
Thanks, David.
I won't do the thing they do on sports shows where we play your predictions from January and then get to hear how you got it all wrong. So, but let me start with Dan Barlow from VBSR and talk about what how things went in the socially responsible business world, concerns that businesses have had, and how they fared in the legislature.
Sure. You know, coming into this legislative session, we were looking at passing a minimum wage increase, you know, getting Vermonters to $15 an hour minimum in the next few years, also establishing, you know, a paid family and medical leave system here, and then finally looking for action on climate change, which is, you know, the most pressing issue of our world right now, and the kind of crisis that a generation is defined by when how they respond to it. Unfortunately, you know, we ended up the session with the minimum wage bill and the paid family leave bill stalled over disagreements between the House and the Senate, and really no meaningful action on climate change.
Can you give us some insight into how the session ended, which was in rather bizarre fashion, where the House adjourned on a Friday, the Senate wrapped up 4 days later in the futile hope that the House might come to agreement with it. What happened there?
Yeah, it was quite surreal, and I've been up at the State House since 2007, so I've seen quite a bit over the years, and this one was really one for the history books. You know, we knew going into the session that raising the minimum wage was a big priority for the Senate, and establishing paid family leave was a big priority for the House, and that hopefully the two would work together to advance those proposals hand in hand, recognizing that they each had a role in looking at these bills and passing these bills. Unfortunately, you know, we came to the end of the session where the minimum wage bill passed by the House was considered too weak for the Senate. And meanwhile, the Senate took out some key provisions of the paid family leave bill that were really important to the House. So you really saw these two issues, you know, collide together at the end of the session as being two of the final bills left in play. And, you know, House Speaker Mitzi Johnson in many ways kind of called the bluff of Senate President Tim Ash you know, adjourned on a Friday. And I know the Senate was hoping that the House would come around and maybe, you know, reconvene with them the following week. That did not happen. And then the Senate reconvened shortly for a little bit last Wednesday before adjourning for the session with these two major priorities left unfinished, because both chambers passed very different versions of the bills.
It sort of strikes me as an own goal by the Democratic supermajority that they handed to the Republican governor.
You know, exactly. A lot of the talk was, you know, the Democratic legislature sent both these bills to the governor last year. He vetoed those, and there was a sense of, okay, we took a principled stand last year, and let's get something to the governor that he could actually sign. And unfortunately, it came down to, you know, the House and Senate disagreeing. At times, it felt a little bit like, you know, mom and dad were fighting, and now we're not going to Disneyland.
Well, so all that said, what are the prospects for these two bills, which have been signature issues, certainly for VBSR, $15 minimum wage and paid family leave? What are the prospects going forward?
You know, from what I've heard from leadership in both the House and Senate is that they are committed to getting these bills done and off to the governor, you know, roughly within the first month of the second half of the session. So, you know, January 2020, you know, I think that needs to be a real priority. There's a lot of folks out there who are asking, you know, me, what's the point of having a Democratic supermajority when they struggle to pass kind of basic liberal or progressive legislation?
And how do you answer the concern that was expressed by some that, well, and by some legislators, well, the governor's going to veto these things anyway, particularly on paid family leave? It sounded like he was more open to the $15 minimum wage.
Yeah, that was always a dynamic here. And, you know, the governor put out his own proposal on paid family leave in the beginning of the session, a voluntary system. And I think he really drew a hard line in the sand there. So that was always going to face a tough conversation when that bill came to the governor. But additionally, on minimum wage, I think you're right, David. Like, he did signal at times that he was open to an increase. I know as a state senator, he voted for a bill that tied minimum wage increases to CPI, the Consumer Price Index. And there was a sense that maybe he'd be willing, as governor, to sign something very similar.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're doing a roundtable with some of Vermont's leading advocates on legislation and how it fared now that we're at the end of the legislative session. If you want to join this conversation, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Lauren Hurl from the Vermont Conservation Voters, I know you worked very closely on a bill relating to medical monitoring of toxics. Explain what the bill was and how it fared.
Came out of work done really following the discovery of PFAS contamination down in drinking water wells in Bennington, and then it's popped up in other parts of the state and really all over the country. They're wrestling with, you know, this toxic contamination of drinking water. And so this bill would give Vermonters who have been exposed to a toxic chemical because of a corporate polluter nearby, so they now have increased levels of a chemical in their body because of that pollution and need increased medical care because of that. They need screening for the diseases linked to exposure to that chemical. And it comes down to a basic issue of fairness. Who should pay for that? Is that the victim of the toxic pollution or the corporation that caused the pollution? And so this bill says we want to say that Vermonters should be able to recover those medical costs for screening due to toxic exposure and have the polluter pay for that. It's legislation that passed on strong votes this year. It was a bill vetoed. A similar bill was vetoed last year by the governor. There were some changes made this year, but we know it's still an open question of, you know, what the governor is going to do with it. He's already expressed some initial concerns about the impacts of this bill on businesses.
And when will the governor take action on this?
The last we had checked, the bill had not yet reached his desk, but sometime, you know, we're guessing in the next week or so that decision will be made. So, you know, we've been encouraging our members and other Vermonters to contact the governor and let him know that Vermonters support signing that bill. But, yeah, we would guess in the next week or so. We should see a decision one way or another.
One of the moments of drama in the building, in the State House, in the closing weeks of the session was a protest by people calling for climate action and complaining the legislature had not done enough. What's your take on what was accomplished around climate action legislation?
This is an area, you know, there were some areas in our environmental agenda where we were excited. There were some nation-leading bills. Climate change, on the other hand, was an area where we had come in, a whole coalition of groups, including some of the groups on the call, on the show today, VPIRG, VBSR, but also affordable housing groups, low-income advocates, and others calling for a range of climate solutions. And we saw really modest progress. We were looking for investments in helping people weatherize their homes, helping people access more efficient vehicles, electric vehicles. And there were some investments put into electric vehicles. There were some investments put into more weatherization. But it fell far short of the amount of investment we had called for. And there were other policies we were hoping to put in place to really get us on track to meet our climate goals and commitments. And we really were disappointed to see where we landed on climate this year.
What do you think accounts for the lack of action?
To some degree, I think we really need to see leadership, and that would include coming out of the governor's office as well as the speaker and the pro tem, you know, putting this up at the top of the priority list. And that's what we're really going to be working for heading into next legislative session. You know, there were a lot of things that they were prioritizing, the paid family leave and minimum wage you were talking about a few minutes ago. And really, you know, we need to push to make sure that climate action, this huge global crisis, is something that we are putting front and center of the legislative agenda in 2020 so we can be taking the kinds of steps that we need to take.
How do you think that the presidential election in 2020 will affect your chances of getting a different outcome next January?
Well, it's been really interesting to see how the discussion around climate change really does seem to be shifting. Even, you know, there have been recent polls showing that climate change and action on climate is something that voters are prioritizing in a way that really hasn't been the case in the past. It's an issue that people are saying is right up there with healthcare as the kinds of things that government needs to be focusing on. So I think the momentum and the national conversation at the presidential level and, you know, what I imagine will happen around the gubernatorial race here and legislative races could really shine a spotlight on how important this issue is to voters and the real need to transition to clean and affordable energy solutions.
One of the perennial issues now is clean water funding, cleaning up Lake Champlain. At the end, there seemed to be a novel funding formula that the treasurer signed off on. Can you just explain where we ended up on funding for clean water?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the end of the day, what the legislature ended up putting in place was saying that a certain portion of our existing rooms and meals tax, so the tax that we pay if we go out to dinner or rent a hotel room, it didn't increase that tax. It just said we're going to dedicate a portion of that to our clean water fund. And they essentially said we can get away with doing that because there are changes in the federal tax system out of the new tax laws that passed a couple years ago that we anticipate Vermont will be bringing in more revenue because of the way those kind of changes have played out. And so that new revenue that's anticipated will kind of cover that amount of clean water funding that we're going to dedicate. So we can get away with not raising a new tax this year. We're just going to dedicate this rooms and meals tax to clean water fund. And they were estimating that would be about $12 million a year over the longer term. So it's, you know, to us, it was it's great to get a new boost of money for the clean water fund. You know, we were hopeful that it would be a new revenue source so that the existing budget didn't get impacted. You know, we want to make sure that we're not creating a hole in the budget in future years for other important state programs. But we are, you know, encouraged to see that a significant increase in the amount of money going towards clean water.
Right. We almost wish that the legislature was in session in the summer when these algae blooms occur and cause these you know, really huge crises in communities in St. Albans, you know, elsewhere on the bay, on the Champlain, Lake Champlain. You know, the having these discussions in winter gives you the luxury of not feeling the urgency of the issue, I think.
Yeah.
Well, we're continuing our conversation with advocates from around the state. We've heard from Dan Barlow of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, Lauren Hurl from Vermont Conservation Voters, which brings us to Paul Burns from the Vermont Public Interest Research Group. Paul, VPIRG has probably the broadest range of issues that you cover, from toxics to government reform. And I know you've just been talking about the ban on single-use plastics. You were on Dave Graham talking about that, and that was certainly a big accomplishment of your group. Talk about some of the other issues that came up for you, and I gather this was an up-and-down session.
It really was, and we've been hearing some of that in the conversation already on this program, but we were happy to work with Lauren and Vermont Conservation Voters, Conservation Law Foundation, and others on some important bills to deal with chemical exposure. Lauren mentioned the medical monitoring bill. This is also a year where we finally put on the governor's desk again a bill to better protect children from toxic chemicals that are specifically put into children's products, toys, clothes, and other items. A similar bill was passed by the legislature, sent to the governor last year, and he vetoed it with concerns about the impact that it might have on manufacturing. We think that wasn't really a legitimate concern. This is a relatively small number of products, and what we're talking about is try to make sure that the health commissioner has the authority that he or she needs to protect children from potentially dangerous and toxic products. So we were surprised when he vetoed it last year. But we fell four votes short in a veto override last year on that bill in the House of Representatives. The override passed in the Senate. A similar bill was passed, had overwhelming support. The vote was 137-4, if I remember correctly, in the House this year, 25-5 in the Senate. Whether the governor signs it or not, I feel pretty confident that one way or another this bill is going to pass and offer better protections in the future for children, and also give parents and others buying children's products a little bit more and better information about the toxic chemicals in those products. So we've been working on that for 5 years. I really hope that this is the year that one way or another that's going to become law. So we're kind of looking forward to that. Speaking of children and toxics, there was some controversy for a time about whether the House and Senate could get together on a bill to require testing for lead in drinking water in every school and child care center in the state. Ultimately, the House and Senate committees of jurisdiction worked out their differences, and they sent that bill to the governor. We do expect the governor to sign it, and importantly, you know, a lot of people kind of assume that we've already been checking water in our schools and child care centers for lead. But the standards did not require, you know, regular testing. The action level was quite high. So this has produced a much lower level, 4 parts per billion, as a trigger. So if you find a water tap in a school or child care center that violates that, this law will also require remediation, either taking that tap offline or making the fix necessary so that children are not drinking out of a water system that has too high levels of lead. And of course, any lead is bad for human health, causes particular problems. It is a neurotoxin. There's no debate about whether this is safe or not. It is not safe. And so we're really happy to see Vermont making some progress there with one of the strong, or probably the strongest law in the country to protect kids from lead in school drinking water. You would think we wouldn't have to still be fighting battles like that, but it's important that we be diligent in fighting those and making sure that we're protecting our kids.
Now, there was just a survey done of lead in school drinking water, and what did it find?
That was a pilot program, looked at 16 different schools in the state, and in each one of those schools, they found levels of lead that were at least higher than 1 part per billion, which is the standard that the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended for action. That is to say, if there's anything higher than 1 part per billion of lead in the water, children shouldn't be drinking it. That is their position. That was our position going in. The state ultimately settled on a standard of 4 parts per billion, and even at that, again, it will be the toughest standard in the country. But that's much lower than what had been a standard of 15. There was no regular testing required previously, and it was just if they happened to find it above 15, they were to take action. That's really a very high standard for lead. There is no question that children are being harmed at that standard of lead in the water.
Well, let's turn to a caller. Karen is calling from Hardwick. Karen, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Hi. I'm wondering, when these people talk about cleaning up the lake and how much money they need, nobody ever mentions the millions of gallons of leachate from the Coventry dump that are being trucked to Barrie and Montpelier and put into the sewage system. And when that overflows, that unknown leachate goes right into the lake, into the river and then the lake. Who's doing anything about that? Not to mention that this Casella outfit, they have hundreds of trucks, MBI it says on them. They truck all the trash to Coventry. They're registered out of state, and they're tearing up our roads.
Thanks for the question. Very interesting and troubling thought there about the leachate. Which one of our guests would like to
talk to that? Thanks.
This is Paul from VPIRG. I want to note that Conservation Law Foundation has really been leading some of the statewide efforts as it relates to the landfill and the dealing with the leachate that comes from that landfill. For our part, we and VCV and others have encouraged local communities not to take that untreated waste. And it's part of our goal is really not to see an immediate expansion of that landfill either. Really, we should use this time of kind of pressure with a landfill that's filling up to encourage more to be done to reduce the amount of waste that we generate rather than just expanding for another 25 years the size of that landfill so that it can receive all the waste that we may want to send there. But this leachate, it is troublesome. It is does contain toxic materials, contaminants, including potentially PFAS. These are perfluorinated chemicals, similar to what we found in drinking water, private drinking water supplies in Bennington. And it is not good, and the local treatment facilities are not designed to treat for that kind of chemical contamination. So when it leaves there and goes into waterways, it can be a significant issue.
I did want to just note that there was a piece of legislation passed this year that was looking at testing water supplies, including surface water and all drinking water across the state for PFAS contamination, and it was particularly looking at leachate as one of these possible sources and making sure that we're getting a better handle on where are these chemicals moving, and so at least we should be able to get a sense of, what's the extent of the problem of PFAS contamination, and is leachate really contributing to that problem, and we need to do a better job with how we're dealing with it, which I am guessing the answer is probably going to be yes, but we'll at least get data to start getting better policies in place.
And that one was signed by the governor, so that's the first statewide standard for drinking water for the PFAS chemicals.
Paul Burns, what do you feel like is the opportunity for VPIRG and others in the next session? What's the low-hanging fruit for you that you want to pick right away?
Well, this is the second year in a row that the Senate has passed a bill to ban corporate contributions to political campaigns. We still think that a lot of the challenges when it comes to getting any of these good bills passed does come back to the influence that certain, particularly corporate entities, have over the legislature and over the political process. So for the second year in a row, the House has stalled that bill, hasn't taken action on it. They'll have plenty of time in 2020. They have no excuse that they don't have enough time to do it. The Senate has put it on their desks, has put another bill on their desk to look at how we can make our state's system of public financing work better. So this, I think, will allow for better solutions to be more thoroughly vetted and considered if we can get rid of this money in politics.
Okay, well, that does it for our conversation. I want to thank all of you, Paul Burns from VPIRG, Lauren Hurl from Vermont Conservation Voters, and Dan Barlow from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. Thanks for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
That does it for this week's show. You can hear this and all shows at VermontConversation.com. Come next Monday to Bridgeside Books. I'll be talking with Bill McKibben, and that will be our topic next Wednesday on the Vermont Conversation. Tune in then at 1 here on WDEV. The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, ski erg, and bike erg, and proud to support nonprofit groups such as Salvation Farms, which nourishes Vermont by distributing produce farmers can't sell. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable childcare in Vermont to better support our children, families, community, and economy. Green Mountain Power, delivering clean, cost-effective, and highly reliable power to customers and offering cutting-edge products and services to reduce costs and carbon. The Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, a proud B Corp using the power of business to support a clean environment and economic opportunity for all. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. And by Stowe Cider, with crisp, clean, and creative award-winning flavors. Visit the tasting room in Stowe or buy Stowe Cider throughout New England, upstate New York, and Washington, D.C. As well as nearly 700 business members of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit.